This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Welcome to the Urologist Speak. This is Guardian Radio 96.9. This is with your host, Dr. Gregory Pinto, and co-host, Dr. Wesley Francis. Dr. Pinto is not here today. He has a professional obligation. He couldn't be here. So this is Dr. Wesley Francis, who will be flying solo. But I have two guests with me tonight. And I want to welcome them to the show. In studio today, we have Dr. Bernard McPhee and Dr. Kristen Nottage, all members of the Research Princess Margaret Hospital. Welcome to the Urologist Speaks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night, Bombers.
Good night, everyone.
So this is Guardian Radio 96.9. We're streaming live on radio and video on guardiantalkradio.com. You can listen on TV on Cable Bahamas channel 96.9 or BTC Flow channel 612. You can download the Guardian Radio app from your Apple or Android smart device and listen to our audio feed or watch us on the video feed right there on the Guardian Radio app. You can text us on Guardian Radio text line 422-GR96 or 424-796, powered by BTC, standard text rate supply, or you can call us on 323-6232 or 325-4316 or 326-4259, or call toll-free from the Family Islands 242-300-5720. Okay, so tonight we're going to have a slightly different show. I know Pinto and myself, we always usually come on and we talk about health concerns. A lot of it is heavy on cancer, but we also try to talk about things that are relevant to patients' health in the community and try to overall improve health literacy. But tonight, I want to take a little twist and bring you or introduce you or the community to how it's evolved over the years to meet the needs of the Bahamian public. And this is why I've invited two of my colleagues to come tonight so that we can let you know or bring you into our world a little, give you a little education about what happens in Princess Margaret Hospital, Department of Surgery, and how does the surgical community evolved over the years, and how we serve you. So the one thing I want to talk about and what inspired this show is that I want to give a shout out to Dr. Harold Munnings, who's one of our gastroenterologists and our medical historian. And he's an all-around guy, individual, and he authored many books. And one of the books he authored is Healthcare in the Bahamas, 200 Years of Growth and Development. And if any of you get a chance to pick up a copy of this book, it really, really talks about healthcare in the Bahamas, how it's evolved over the years. So tonight, we're going to take a little bit, or talk a little bit about the history of surgery, and then discuss how you become a surgeon and how, in the final segment, we want to interact with the public and basically, you know, let you into our world, get you to have some interaction with surgeons who are presently serving you in your community. So if you read Munnings' book, and he gives a little history of Princess Margaret Hospital, and the hospital opened in 1953. It actually employed a surgeon, an anesthetist, and a pathologist. You know, it was first known as the Bahamas General Hospital, but then named Princess Margaret Hospital in 1955 on the visit of the lovely Princess Margaret to the island. In the book, Munnings referenced two, and some of you may recognize these names. There was a Dr. Ricardo de Gregory, who was educated in the UK, and he was the chief anesthesiologist. And at the time, the chief surgeon was a Dr. Clinton Thomas. And in the book, it describes Clinton Thomas as a guy, a typical surgeon, very difficult person, larger-than-life guy, difficult to get along with. And it so happens that the two, Dr. de Gregory and Dr. Thomas, could not get along. And so here you have the big chief surgeon and the chief anesthesiologist, and they didn't even speak. And at the time, and some of you may recognize his name, there was a young doctor called Dr. Cecil Bethel. And if you remember, or any of you, Dr. Cecil Bethel was actually our first internal medicine specialist. Dr. Bethel at the time had not gone off to train as yet, but he got caught in the anesthesia department. And because these two doctors could not get along, Dr. Bethel got so much training in anesthesia that he was relegated to do all the cases of Dr. Thomas. So because the chief anesthesiologist refused to work with the chief surgeon, Dr. Cecil Bethel, who later became our first internal medicine specialist, did all the anesthesiology for Dr. Thomas. I thought that was an interesting story when I read it. So, but how did it all begin in Princess Margaret Hospital? The first Bahamian surgeon was Dr. Earl Farrington. Now, many of you might have heard this name. He studied in Glasgow. He became the first Bahamian head of department. Farrington, and he worked very hard, all by himself, many days. And just to give you some context, back in those days, there was only a consultant and maybe one junior person. Back then, he had a gentleman that I'm told was from Uganda. The name was Dr. Garrett. And Garrett was his registrar. Now, in the UK or British system, which we kind of still adopt in the Bahamas, although we have somewhat of a hybrid, there was a consultant, a senior registrar, senior house officer, and a house officer. So a house officer is like an intern. They would have finished medical school, and then they start working. Senior house officer is after you would have completed your internship, then you work. And then if you got some sort of postgraduate degree, you'd become a registrar or senior registrar. So Dr. Farrington had this gentleman named Dr. Garrett, who I was told was a very large man from Africa. He's from Uganda. Someone described that he looked almost like Idi Amin, if anybody knows who that person is, right? But I'm told that he was a very, very skilled surgeon, very good hands, and he worked for a long time with Dr. Garrett. There was also, at the time, Dr. Sony, who did also some general surgery, but he really did mostly neurosurgery. And this is before the days of Dr. Nuri. Some of you may recognize that name also. There was another general surgeon from India called Dr. Bhattachary. But most of the work was really done in the public sector by Dr. Earl Farrington. Now, the other group of general surgeons started to come home. And I just want to mention, general surgery, back in those days, they did everything. They did a little bit of neurosurgery. They did a little bit of cardiac surgery. They did urology. They did orthopedics. They did everything. It's only now we're kind of subspecialized. But Farrington, in those days, did almost everything. So the first guy to come back was in 1980 was Dr. Campbell, ENT. So he kind of took over all of the ENT practice. And then from a general surgery perspective, a young, they call him a real charismatic surgeon, Nicholas Hepburn. Nicholas Hepburn came home and, you know, and I'm giving the pearls of our department. Nicholas Hepburn kind of maneuvered his way, and he became a consultant, and he dispatched Garrett. Garrett went to Freeport. All of this is some interesting background on how we got where we are. Now, Hepburn worked along with Farrington, but they worked separately. Farrington got sick at some point with Guillain-Barré, those of you, this is a neurological disorder. And then, so basically, Hepburn took over at that point in time. And then after that, another larger-than-life surgeon came home. And that person would be Slimy Thompson. Now, many of you out there, you know Slimy. Slimy was a larger-than-life guy, very different from Hepburn, a different kind of surgeon. I had the pleasure of working with Slimy Thompson, and all he used to talk about, the larger the incision, the better your operation. And some of you might have had surgery done by Slimy Thompson. He did not believe anything in minimally invasive. It had to be big. And he was that larger-than-life surgeon, all kind of personality, a junkanooa. And so real character and a really good guy. After Slimy Thompson, then Dr. Loxley Monroe, who's still around today and still works. Loxley retired recently from the department. And so back then you had this trio of Thompson, Hepburn, and Monroe. And you guys here may not remember this, but I was an intern back in that time during those three. And we worked every third night on call. And once on one weekend a month, we had to go to work from Saturday morning and finish Monday. And if you were on Thompson service, and because they had operating room on a Monday, you would go to work on Saturday and leave Monday evening. This is the kind of work that was being done in the Department of Surgery at the time. Then Dr. Sands came, and Dr. Sands did his general surgery in Wayne State. He did general surgery, and he did also cardiothoracic surgery. And then they added another team. So we moved from working every third night to now, still what is now today, every fourth night. Dr. Shea, who is still here, he's retired now, but he works in private practice, took over from Thompson. And up to maybe 2 years ago, basically, you had Thompson, you had Shea, Hepburn, but then Dr. Farquharson came and took over from Hepburn, then Shea. And those were the four teams that were there. So what's interesting is during that period of time, we had a lot of junior people in the department, but we never really had a program that trained surgeons. Everybody who was in the department had to leave and go and train elsewhere. And I'm going to give you some names of the people who were senior house officers in the department during that time. And this would have been sometime in the early 2000s. Valentine Grimes. Valentine Grimes is now the current head of the department. Delton Farquharson, who took over eventually from Dr. Hepburn. Dane Bowe, who orthopedics, and he's now retired. Colleen Fitzcharles, Carlton Chambers, and yours truly, Wesley Francis. So during that time, we were all working in the department as senior house officers. And there was no opportunity to train. We all had to basically leave the Bahamas and go and travel elsewhere. Now, in 2004, the training program started, and the training program became a five-year program, and it was twinned with Jamaica. Now, if you go back, Dr. Loxley Munro was really the first Bahamian who finished that program in Jamaica and came back home. Between then and now, no one had finished that program. Dr. Shea, who had come back, he trained in Canada. So most of the people in the department either trained in North America, either Canada, the U.S., but Dr. Loxley Munro trained in Jamaica. Our program, which we developed locally, then we saw that there was a need basically to develop our own. Because there was a huge gap then, the guys working in the department like myself, we couldn't train and we needed to get training and go off. Now, I must say, the government did give in-service awards to some people, especially to go to Canada. And that's how Valentine Grimes, Delton Farquharson, Dane Bowe, Colleen Fitzcharles, they got to leave. Carlton Chambers, who is also an orthopedic specialist now, he went back to Jamaica. And myself, I got an opportunity to go to the U.S. And I trained in Wayne State University, and only because Dr. Dwayne Sands had trained there previously, and he opened that door, and I got there. So in 2004, we developed our own residency program. And a residency program is basically a training program for surgeons. And now, since then, we have graduated over 8 surgeons. And today, 2 of those surgeons are in this on the program today, and we're going to discuss the journey from then to now where we are. As I'd mentioned, everybody had to leave and then come back, but then we developed our own program. Our own program, the first 2 years were that of basic sciences, where you had to learn anatomy, physiology, pathology, principles of surgery. And then the last year is where you got your clinical experiences. We also opened doors for people to go away to get our training and then actually come back home. I want to mention that when I came back in 2009, the first set of the graduates to pass the first part was Dr. Nicholas Burrows. So Nicholas Burrows, he's now currently a consultant neurosurgeon here. When he passed the first part of our training program, he went back to Jamaica, did neurosurgery, and then came back to Princess Margaret Hospital in 2 years. Then Alfred Dawes, he had also finished, and he stayed with us for about 2 years before going to Jamaica. I remember Dr. Dawes fondly because when I first came home, he and I had some wild nights on call. And this was when we worked a whole lot. I do remember one time, and this is an interesting case that we had. Gentleman got shot in his chest, and the bullet migrated from into his heart and moved all the way to his legs, and we didn't even realize this until later on. And that was one of the very rare, unique things, and I think we wrote that up and reported that.
Bullet ambulance.
Yes, bullet ambulance. You were here during that time.
Preparing that.
Right. But these were the kind of cases that we did in Princess Margaret Hospital. And there was a lot of trauma. And trauma was the basis of our training and for the training going on. So now I'm going to start a history of where we came from. I remember when I came on, I joined Dr. Shea's team. as a senior registrar. And I worked under Dr. Shea for a time period. And then Shea left for a bit. I continued on that service. But at the time, because I did surgical oncology, I used to go down, I used to do Shea Clinic and then go down to oncology clinic and started a clinic there by myself. And now this is where, that's where the surgical oncology clinic developed, because I just decided I was going to do Shea Clinic and then go do this other clinic too. And this is how things happened. And Dr. Sands at the time, when Shea came back, decided he was done with general surgery and he just wanted to continue on with cardiac surgery and vascular surgery. And so he gave up general surgery, and that's how I got on to do my own team. And so today, the teams that exist are, well, prior to Monroe retiring and Shea retiring, we had Shea, Monroe, Francis, Farquharson. And you can see how that the generations kind of developed, or how the teams developed. They took away the names of the teams, and now the teams are A, B, C, and D. Okay? So that's the kind of an overview of where we came from. And this is the first break. And in the next break, we're going to interact with our guests who have trained during the program. We're going to get their experience. So we'll see you on the top of the next break.
Loss of family members is very isolating, and people who have experienced loss appreciate when others have shared their grief. If you can't be there in person, go to the Nassau Guardian's website online at thenassauguardian.com and visit our obituary link. The Nassau Guardian's interactive obituary link allows you to read the funeral announcement, express condolences, or place photos on the online guestbook for one full year. Losing a loved one is painful, but that pain isn't the worst thing to happen. Friends, loved ones, colleagues, and neighbors who ignore the loss compound the pain. Should the bereaved family wish to place the obituary and photos on our obituary site, just contact the Guardian's funeral industry partners or the Nassau Guardian. Remember, there isn't one magic right thing to say to someone experiencing loss that will make the loss less painful or easier to bear. The Nassau Guardian's obituary link, available online at thenassauguardian.com.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Okay, we're back. And so I've given you the overview of our department. And one of the things that you can tell from that is that the department is really young. And we have evolved. And as I mentioned, the training program started. We've graduated 8. And I want to call their names. Our first graduate was, who stayed the entire time in the program was Don Major. He's my partner, and he went on to do a fellowship in surgical oncology. Dr. Terrell Humes, he went on and did minimally invasive surgery and bariatrics, and he is in Freeport. And then there's Dr. Vantario Taylor, who also went on and did a fellowship. And so what a fellowship is this is training after you to become a specialist, sort of subspecialty training. And he did transplant surgery. Dr. Charles Lucas, he's a vascular surgeon at PMH now. And then there was Dr. Renard McPhee, who is 80. Dr. Bodie was supposed to be here. She's homesick. Shout out to Dr. Bodie. Get well soon. And then Krista Nottage, who is with us tonight, also in studio. And then the last person who actually just graduated, and congratulations to Dr. Holly Nixon, who just passed his exams in Jamaica and will be joining us soon. So, guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just want to ask you, and we'll start with Renard, mm-hmm. What made you go into surgery? And what your experience has been like in the department?
My background stems from Exuma, so I'm an island boy, grew up, and I always found myself trying to put band-aids on everyone. So when everyone is on the playground, they know to come to me for the little cuts, the bruises, things like that. And it literally was me not even knowing where I was heading. And in high school at Ellen Coakley, my guidance counselor, Ms. Patel, had sat me down and asked, you know, what do you want to do? And at that point, up to almost like grade 11, grade 12, I was still, I want to be an astronaut. And she's like, you know, that's a good idea, but is there anything more practical you might want to consider? And I told her, well, you know, I always loved the sciences, and she kind of steered me in the right direction. And shout out to guidance counselors. They're really an invaluable part of the educational system and can help direct persons who may not know where their path leads. And through that, I went to what was then the COB and did a bachelor's in biology with chemistry. And at there, I heard about this place called University of the West Indies. They had a college fair. I was very much interested. At first, I didn't have anything to get some further training, especially on the medical side, because we didn't have a medical school established at that time. So I was able to apply and get into their natural sciences program. And after 2 years of matriculating in the natural science program, I applied, and through my academics was able to get accepted into the medical school.
This was in Mona?
This is in Mona, okay. In Mona, Jamaica.
Right.
So that led to a 5-year journey done all in Jamaica at that time. And led me to the MBBS degree, which is that qualifying to become an intern. I returned home in the department that was described, saw all these towering figures, you know, all this stuff, and got inspired even more, because as an intern, I always found the surgical rotation to be the one that grabbed my interest. I found the others to be boring and things that I just had to get through. But my calling was always towards the surgical things. That's the thing that got my blood boiling. So at the earliest opportunity, I applied, and thankfully, you know, got accepted into the surgical department as an SHO. Worked in the department for many years, and then realized there was another opportunity to advance further, and that was in joining the program. At that point, it was kind of a little bit almost on the roll the dice experimental side, because it was a young fledgling surgical residency program, and no one wants to be the first sort of guinea pig. I wasn't the first, but I was still kind of wondering, you know, if there's a pathway I should take. I made my mind up, and I think it was the best decision of my life.
All right, that's great. How did you tell us about your journey?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And it's very special for me to be here, because both you, Dr. Francis, and Dr. McPhee have mentored me in my development as a doctor and as a surgeon. Dr. McPhee used to take us as medical students and teach us about instruments and x-rays and all those things. And of course, I think some of my earliest in operating theater experiences were on the service of Dr. Francis. And I think you were a senior house officer at that time, Dr. McPhee. So I am from Nassau, and I think early on, I just wanted to be whatever my brother wanted to be, and being a physician was the first career choice that I'd made on my own, and I was very heavily influenced by my pediatricians. I had the wonderful Dr. McNeil and Dr. Rose, and I loved going to their office. I loved the way they were able to figure out how to make me feel better. They understood something about the body that was interesting to me. They put their stethoscope on, and I wondered, what were they hearing? Can I hear? When they use the knee hammer, what does that mean? So I became very engaged in medicine through my pediatrician. I really think that they're an important part of the community because they're making such a big impression on children. After that, it really was television, I think, was the next big influence. I mean, I have physicians in my family, but I really didn't know what they do. And now I look at them very differently because I'm like, did you go through this struggle? And they're like, yes, nobody sees the struggle. Everyone sees the end result. And I'm like, oh, I understand that now. But television at that time, we had Chicago Hope and ER, and certainly the excitement of being a physician captivated me. So I knew I wanted to do medicine, and or a cardiothoracic surgeon. I went into UE. Well, in deciding where I wanted to go, I had done most of my education abroad, both for high school and for university. And my dad sat me down one summer, and he said, you know, you've done all of this education abroad, and it's so important to me that you do some element of your training in your region. He thought it would be important for developing networking ties, for being in touch with your people. So he really, we had a great discussion about this, about why it should be UE. And so fate would have it that all of these things came into play. Many things happened over that summer and over the next year that led me to University of the West Indies Mona campus. So it seems as though we were all trained, well, Dr. McPhee and I were trained at Mona. I don't know which campus you were trained at.
I actually was at Mona also.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're all Mona graduates. And we say that because there are actually three campuses that you can do your initial medical training at. There's Mona in Jamaica, St. Augustine in Trinidad, and then there's Barbados campus as well.
Yeah.
And so you do your first, usually your first 3 years there, and then you come home for your last 2 years. Now, during Dr. McPhee's time, all 5 years were done at the Mona campus. During my time, I was just the cusp of the creation of the School of Clinical Medicine and Research, where we were encouraged to come home and do our final, in my time it was the final year, and now it's the final 2 years, rotating at the Princess Margaret Hospital. So I did that. I knew I wanted to do surgery. I finished my internship. I actually went into internal medicine. Yeah, I did. And I think my background in my first degree was in anthropology, so the study of culture. And I had done a summer at the Ministry of Health at what they called the HIV or AIDS Secretariat. And I really wanted to look at how stigma affected patients and persons' access to healthcare. So it's all about the culture around how we discuss illness and around how we stigmatize certain illnesses. So I got an introduction to infectious diseases there, and it really piqued my interest. But internal medicine, I thought, was a great foundation for any direction.
Right.
And so I went into internal medicine. I spent a year there, but staying true to my heart, I went into surgery. And why surgery? Well, the body's so interesting. And internal medicine can look at you, they can listen to everything that's going on, put together a picture, and they come up with a treatment plan. And they are able to make you feel better by doing that. But surgery is afforded this very special position where we get to see into the mechanics of the body.
Yeah, it's very personal.
Right. And so I enjoyed being able to look at the, for lack of a better term, internal plumbing. So I always joke that surgeons are like plumbers, really. We see a blockage, we take it out, we reroute it. Yeah, we bypass this. So I enjoyed that physical aspect of surgery. And there is some gratification of seeing the problem, feeling it in your hands.
Fixing it. Stay fixed.
Right. And so surgery is where I went. And so looking at where to do the program, I was very heavily influenced by Dr. Francis, actually, who at that time was kind of emerging as the leader in our local DM program. And he encouraged us to do it. There are those who had done it before, And by no stretch of the imagination, it's a tough program. It's very difficult. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we who wanted to do it entered, and certainly I did my surgical training here at home, and we're among the few who've been able to do that, and it is a privilege to be able to do that in your home country.
Mm-hmm. So you speak about how tough the program was, and I mean, I want to hopefully get both of you to talk about it. You know, people think about surgeons as, you know, they think Grey's Anatomy, that's where art try to imitate life. Mark Fee, tell us about, you know, your daily life when you were a resident. How, you know, what was the greatest moments for you? But how was things day to day? How did it impact your life? How did it impact your family? All of those things.
My family definitely had to be long-suffering because the days of call going from morning to night into the following morning without a shower, having to be there, you know, up at 3 a.m. responding to the traumas and the different things, the appendicitis. It was exciting, but it was very grueling on the body and it was very grueling on the family dynamics because at some point, you know, you have other things that happen. The kids come along, in my case. So my wife had to be definitely the strong one taking care of all of the things while I'm there deep in the books, trying to prepare for this exam, trying to prepare for this presentation, trying to get everything done. The highlights were there, but it also meant that a lot of time away from home and things that I love doing, but that sacrifice was always in my mind a part of a process, the process that led to being able to see that fulfillment on someone's face when I was able to save a limb or recover, you know, what was some dysfunctional part of the body. So those rewards were priceless, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I definitely think that anyone who enters this has to have that mental discipline to be able to say delayed gratification.
Yeah. So Nadesh, what about you? How has this impacted your life overall, the time that you had to spend in the hospital, the interaction with you and your family? Give us a little insight into that.
Well, self, as a young woman, it's very difficult because there's so much that you have to take into account. So, for instance, I don't have children yet. There's a book called The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born, so I hold that in my heart. I'm not married. And it's not to say that you cannot do it, but you have to realize the time. So this training takes a toll on your body, yes, because you're tired. It takes a toll on your mind because you're always on. It takes a toll on all of your relationships. And so your relationships with your parents, with your friends. I'm someone's daughter, sister, cousin, friend, right?
Yeah.
And so you end up missing out on many important events. And you really have to remember the goal in mind. So myself and Dr. Bodhi are recent graduates, and I want to acknowledge Dr. Bodhi as the first female general surgeon who has passed through this program. And so that's a huge marker and a huge milestone in our history. And myself having passed just after her. And so it's not easy. So one thing that I always remember is that Dr. Monroe, I worked on his service quite a bit, and actually I was his last resident, his last chief resident before he retired, and he always said, "You are a resident. This is your residence. The Princess Margaret Hospital is your home.
Yep.
You are expected to be here when I arrive, and you stay after I'm gone. You make sure that the patients are well."
Mm-hmm.
So we became a family within the department, and our patients are our family, and we really do approach them in that way, and that's something that I enjoy is my patient interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But how does it take a toll? So there's so many things that you've put off or you've put to the side, and having finished this program, I'm really looking forward to putting those things towards the center of my life. But certainly it's a huge time commitment.
It is. You don't get to clock out. You don't get to say, hey, today is my birthday, tomorrow is Christmas.
Right.
Those things become secondary. You focus more so on the patient outcomes, and that becomes your priority. So that's an adopted lifestyle that I took on, and I think as a surgeon, it's something you have to know getting into there. It's not, oh, I'm going to go and get this nails done today. It might be that that doesn't fall into when this patient needs to go to surgery.
Right.
So let me say one thing. You know, we mentioned how surgery is so personal. And over the years, I'm sure you've had some gratifying times and gratifying nights where everything went well. What about those times when things didn't go right? When you had complications? And you know, we don't want to try to talk about it, but what was the impact of patient complications on you?
I think it has the greater impact than even when I see the good outcomes, because I personalize so much of it. I literally feel what this person is going through. I speak with the family. I kind of take on this as my relative. And if I have a loss, on my own even, it's literally a personal loss to me. So I have to somehow file that away sometimes and move on to the next situation. But it does take its toll. And at some point, you have to address that that trauma. Because it's traumatic to see some of the things that we see, some of the interpersonal violences that come in. It's kind of heartbreaking at times. But you realize that you have to be above that and just kind of wade through the pain, wade through all the hurt, and move on to be ready for the next person who's coming in.
Yeah, notice, how do you deal with the ups and downs? I mean, surgery has a lot of that.
Right. So I think that's something special about training at home as well, because if you're training in a foreign land or you're training among people who are not necessarily your own, it's different than when someone walks through the door and you're probably only 1 or 2 degrees of separation from that person.
Yeah.
They may be a church member or a cousin of your friend or, right? And so it's very personal to us. When we have complications and when we have, you know, disappointments, we have to have an element of compartmentalization, because on the one ward you have a patient who hasn't done well or has had a complication, you come out of a difficult surgery and you have to go right to accident emergency and approach
pivot.
A new patient
yeah,
with new energy, with new thought process, and try not to carry things over. What we tend to do is vent to each other, because mm-hmm. we can understand what we're going through. And we lean a lot on our seniors in terms of looking at how they've dealt with it, whether we want to mimic how they've dealt with it or whether we see room for change and for improvement to deal with that situation. I remember the first time I was brought face-to-face with the mortality of a patient with whom I'd become very close. This was in my third year of medical training in Jamaica. I was in Montego Bay, and I had a patient that I had to present on ward rounds, and that's another thing. So we do these rounds where we go around and see all the patients, and we present their history, and we discuss. And I had prepared this history for this gentleman who had a stomach cancer, and I didn't really understand the weight of the stomach cancer at that time. And after speaking with him, I had his wife come in from the countryside where she lived, and I interviewed her, and I spoke to all the family members, and I became very close with them. And on ward rounds, I presented the case, and in discussion, it was brought to the fore that, you know, his prognosis was very poor. And my initial reaction, I burst into tears, and I think everyone was just kind of like, whoa. And, you know, at that time, the senior surgeon, he's one of the older senior surgeons, and so I don't think he was used to such expressions of emotion. And so he asked me to step off the ward round and gather myself. Well, I did. And what was so sweet was that patient and his wife, they asked me how I was doing the next day. You know, they were like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm fine. Are you okay? So it's those relationships that mean so much to us, but also to the patient. I think it's important for them to see that
we value that
interaction. But, you know, at another point in time, we have to put our game face on, right? And so we have to be able to tuck those things away and perform.
Yeah, because, you know, the next door, and the patient is there. So we're going to take another break. And on the next side of the break, we're going to open up the lines and entertain questions from the public. Again, this is the Urologist Speak. This is Dr. Wesley Francis. In with Dr. Vernard McPhee and Dr. Kristen Nottage, and this is Urologist Speak.
For fast reliable and impactful printing services, look no further. Let Printmasters bring your Master PD products that is second to none. Our affordable pricing and friendly, efficient staff makes Printmasters the ultimate choice for all your printing needs. We can deliver any type of printing services, from banners to booklets to business cards. You name it, we can print it.
Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located at the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
Wait, you know what's going down tomorrow?
Nobody, what happening?
Joe bringing the knife to school? He could do Junior in?
For what?
Wait, he fooled with Joe girl?
Mother sick. And you know Junior don't bark down for nothing. So that means he got a big fight tomorrow.
So whose side you want?
Side? I trying to stay in school, not Simpson fan. We gotta tell somebody about this fight.
Tell somebody? I ain't no snitch. I mean cool, you know.
Wait, if you so cool, then you need to stay in school and stay out of the fight.
Yeah, but if I don't hang on Joe's side, him and he boys coming for me next.
All right, so we definitely gotta tell somebody. We gotta prevent the fight.
What I say, I don't want nobody calling me snitch.
We could just call Crime Stoppers. You could report what you know, and nobody gotta know it's you.
So out of the way.
All you gotta do is call them, or you text them through the Crack Crime Bahamas app, and nobody can know it's you.
Then the police come looking for me for more info, and when they finish with them, Joe them coming looking for me?
When you call Crime Stoppers, the calls go directly to Miami, and they don't ask nothing about you. Then you can get the pen from them, and you can claim a reward later using that same pen.
Plus, everything's scrambled, so nobody can read what you're saying.
Calls 328-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Okay, this is the final segment of the Urologist Speak, and tonight we have Dr. Renard McPhee and Dr. Kristen Nottage, both general surgeons, newly minted, who in the Department of Surgery. I'm Dr. Wesley Francis, and tonight we're going to entertain your calls. You can call us on 323-6232 or 325-4316. 326-4259. And tonight we're talking about basically surgery in the Bahamas. And we talked a little bit about the history, talk about the present, talk about our residency program, the training program. And, you know, Dr. McPhee and Dr. Nottage shared a little bit about their journey. And so as we wait on interactions from the public, tell me, Dr. McPhee, what's next for you? I mean, where do you see yourself, and what kind of encouragement you'd give for young people out there who may be interested in a career like this?
Okay, for me personally, I have always had an interest in minimally invasive surgery, so I've recently completed some additional training in minimal invasive and robotic surgery because I want to be able to do what I do best without... I'm not a proponent of the big surgery, big cut. I like the idea of small incisions with the same good outcome. So the laparoscopic surgeries are where I want to put my emphasis. I also have an interest in endoscopy and helping persons who have symptoms be diagnosed and ultimately treated if it turns out to be something that needs surgical intervention. I also want to see myself one day as part of the transplant program that's burgeoning in the Bahamas, because as you know, we have a huge burden of end-stage renal disease patients, and our solution at this time tends to be related to fistula hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, and there's another option that a lot of persons don't know about, but that's the transplant option.
Yeah.
Which gives you the ultimate freedom, the closest thing to normalcy that you can find. If we could get that launched, be able to offer the Bahamians that.
Great. Nottage, what about you? Where's this going to lead for you?
Well, I think Dr. Francis kind of explained to you, the public, the structure at the Princess Margaret Hospital. So I am currently a senior registrar. or to be a senior registrar at the hospital. And I'm on the service of Dr. Wesley Francis and Dr. Don Major, and they are surgical oncologists and HPB, or liver and pancreas gallbladder type surgeons. And so I've been somewhat impressed by what they do and enamored with it. And so I'm thinking of surgical oncology, but really I'm interested in breast and endocrine surgery. So endocrine marries, again, my interest in internal medicine and how these tiny little organs balance you, really, the hormones in your body. And one thing can be off and you feel out of whack, and that's your endocrine system. It's and so there are surgeons that deal with endocrine surgery. So that would be your thyroids, your parathyroids, your adrenal glands, right? Secondly, or not really secondly, but just as much, I'm interested in breast surgery. Being a woman and working on the surgical service, we really see young women, young and old, but I was most impressed by the young women who are coming in with breast cancer. And for a long time, our reconstruction availabilities weren't. I think now we definitely have reconstruction available options, in the public sector, and people don't really know. And I'm so interested in doing breast cancer surgery, so mastectomies with reconstruction. I think there's something to be said for a woman who's treating women, particularly with breasts, with breast surgery.
Right.
And so that's my area of interest.
So let me ask you, what would you say to again young women, young men too out there who want to choose a career in surgery? Because this, you know, we talk about a career in medicine, but then even further into surgery. What advice do you have for them?
I would say that it's attainable. It's achievable. It is sacrifice. It is hard work. What isn't sacrifice and what isn't hard work, right? But this, if this is your calling, if this is what you want to do, then by any means necessary. We are here as graduates of the University of the West Indies program. There are other programs that you can apply to if this doesn't tickle your fancy. But if surgery is what you want to do, and I encourage you to spend time with surgeons, work one summer shadowing someone, really try to find out what it is to be a surgeon, what is surgery, if it's something that you like. You may decide you want to do surgery and your first day in operating theater say, yuck, I can't do that.
Yeah, we've had those.
Right. And so, I mean, surgery is a lot of butts and guts. So people might not be so much into that as well, you know. But if it is what you want to do, perseverance. And I look at my partner here, Dr. McPhee, because if there's somebody who knew what he wanted to do and persevered through it all to do it, my hats are off to you.
Thank you.
Every single one of us in this program confront challenges and overcome challenges. And that's also part of grooming for a surgeon, right? Because of the complications, because of the outcomes that you may get, you have to be able to recover. And I think that that's so important to making a surgeon. So I would encourage you first to shadow.
I think we have one call here. Can I answer? Yep. Caller, are you there?
Yes. Good night, Dr. Francis.
Good night.
Dr. McPhee and Dr. Norris.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello?
Yes.
Good evening.
We can hear you.
Oh, this is Mangles.
Oh, hey.
What's up, man?
It's Mangles. Each one of you guys.
Yes.
Yeah. So I listen in all the way from Georgia now. I just want y'all to know that y'all have fans all the way up here.
Oh, wow. It's good
wonderful,
to hear from
man.
You.
It's really good to hear your voice again.
I've been listening for a while now. And one of the questions I wanted to ask is, how would you guys encourage persons who would have travel abroad and studied surgery and want to come back home? What would be their process in coming back home to be a part of the team?
Well,
I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks, sure. Dismangles. And Dismangles was one of our nurses. He was in the emergency room, doctor's hospital. That's where I first met him, and he left. And he's just doing wonderful things, and that's the diaspora. I went away. I trained during my time. There was no training program here, and I went. Like I said, Dr. Sands opened the door for me, and I went to Wayne State, and after that, I went to Calgary. And it was a lot of sacrifice. I mean, I could echo the same things that Dr. McPhee said. why did I come home, though? I mean, I always want to be in the foreign country, to be honest. There's no place like home. And I'm not the only one that left to go away. There are a couple who left with me, and they didn't return. And I'd say I get calls from them all the time wanting to come home because they miss home. The thing about progress in health in the Bahamas is usually when someone leaves, attains the innovation, the technology, or learns these techniques away, and then bring them back home. And that's how we progress. Innovations or changes in healthcare really was driven by physicians who went away and came back. And I mean, we have this residency program now, really. And it's because of, you know, we had to build the capacity. And the capacity was built by going away, coming back. We built the bench. We had enough people here. And then we were able to train. And now for those who are away, I'd say come back and contribute. Because you have to come and contribute to whatever developed you. And that's what I wanted to do. The thing about being away, though, when you come home, there's always it's usually a paradigm shift because a lot of things we have to innovate because we don't have some of the resources that you train. And so when you do come home, you have to be a pioneer. And a lot of people ain't have to be a pioneer. They just want to come and work. You have to be someone to develop. You have to be someone who are going to make changes to improve, to bring something new. You know, Dr. McAfee said he just went off to learn more about minimally invasive and robotic. I just came from France a couple of weeks ago, did the same thing. And I've been around a long time. Because robotic surgery is something that's the new frontier of surgery. And I believe that we need that in the Bahamas too. And we're going to teach folks, you have to come and you have to contribute. This is your country. The country's only going to get better if you invest in it. Mm-hmm. And so that's my advice to anybody who's away to come back home. And we know a lot of those.
And I would say also that for many of those who are the senior surgeons now, especially in the subspecialty areas, they had to bring back the machines that they were used to working with. That's a huge financial burden that they took on to improve the Princess Margaret Hospital. There are instruments that were brought back by individuals that we are all able to use now, right? Mm-hmm. And the technology, and then there are protocols that were written from scratch because we didn't have a protocol on how to do this. But when you came back with your knowledge, you wrote it, and now there's persons like me who are benefiting from it, thinking that this has always been there. So
it's also a golden opportunity because you have now a frontier that you can lead. There are subspecialties that have not yet been filled and areas where persons might have already been near the retirement age. So you get an opportunity to actually be that pioneer, to be that forefront person, as opposed to just being another one of the numbers in the other industrialized places.
Yeah, and that's what you are. You're just another person there. Here, you know, you really can develop. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you say that about technology. You know, and I'll reference Dr. Munning's book, Healthcare in the Bahamas, and it's a great read, right? And it talks about all the development and how people who would have come back would have, at their own expense, brought a lot of equipment to advance. And I think one of the things that when I came back, I mean, I refused to work without the technology, especially with breasts that I learned. And I had to make personal investments and buy certain equipment to make sure, and that led. And now, you know, some of the things now that you take for granted, it started because one of us take our money out of our own pockets and we made those investments and we did. Right. We don't brag about those things a lot, but that's really how things develop. Mm-hmm. If you think just about, I think our time is just about up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having
Greg
us.
Greg is not here today, and he allowed us to come and, you know, take over his show. And thank you, Bahamas, for listening, and I hope you enjoyed our show today. And we'll be here next week with the Urology Speaks. Thank you. Good night, Bahamas.
Good night.
Good night.
I tell you, with early detection
comes early prevention.
Put lead in your pencil, make you feel like a champion.
Rise up again.
Let nothing
psychologist speak.